Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios, New York City. And I welcome you all over the world. Today, we're going to talk about the latest on the omega-3 fatty acids, helping with depression, brand new scientific studies showing that supplements decrease healthcare expenditures across the board, worry, jealousy, moodiness linked to higher risk of Alzheimer's in women, and a new class of cancer-causing estrogens. They're very small, and they're metals, like aluminum, and they're linking to breast cancer. And I'll tell you about what we can do to identify them and get them out of our system. Also, doctors and scientists and survivors break their code of silence and expose the truth about cancer. Won't want to miss this. Plus more. Then we're going to take a look at the environment. We're going to look at the changing Antarctic waters could trigger steep rise in sea levels from Terra Daily and out of Sydney, Australia. Current changes in the ocean around Antarctica are disturbingly close to conditions 14,000 years ago that new research shows may have led to the rapid melting of Antarctic ice and abrupt 4-meter rise around the globe and all of the ocean. You're looking at about a 5-foot increase just from that. And we're not talking about something in the distant future. I've been saying this for some time, that we are in chaos theory. What does that mean? It means that a certain level of tipping, once we have imbalanced a system, it could be in our body, it could be in the environment we're living in, but once you tip it, you cannot predict accurately nor control the outcome. Well, we are tipping. We can't reverse it. In fact, of the 12 major tipping points, there are about 35 all told, at least half now cannot be reversed. So what you have to do is become aware of what it means to have a tipping point, and that will impact where you live, your future, and therefore you can get out of harm's way by knowing the right places to be and how to have a healthy and prosperous future for you and your family, if you choose to be aware of this. Unfortunately, what we're finding is that no matter how realistic the challenge is, most people simply don't want to get out of their comfort zone. They just stay locked in. So I'll go into that. Also, a really sobering article from Common Dreams called "The Planet on the Brink, Human Activity Killing the Planet's Life Support Systems." And what that means, I'll give you that information. Again, this is not about scaring people. It's about informing people so that we can at least know what's happening and address it in our own way, individually and collectively. And finally, from our environmental, it turns out that the EPA knew pesticides were killing honeybees in the 1970s. But if you spoke out about it inside the EPA, you were punished. So now with these pesticides killing honeybees, with as much as 50% of all the bees in America killed in the last 5 years because of a colony collapse, it's mainly due to the neonicotinoid pesticides. They knew this. It was covered up. I'll give you the details on that. And then we go to a really unusual discussion, one that you have not heard. How many times have you watched a short news clip from a Senate or House hearing where the person is sworn in, they make a brief opening statement, generally very differential to the legislators, and then they're asked some questions. And if they're from the establishment, they're asked very soft questions. If there's someone that wants to be demonized, they're asked hard questions. And almost nothing ever comes from any of these hearings. We have found that legislators lie repeatedly and get away with it. Clapper lied, but was not charged with perjury. Now, they can be very selective. If you and I lied, I can assure you we'd probably get a perjury against us, charge against us. There are two tapes I'd like for you to watch today. One, I'm going to play you part of it, as much as time allows, near the end of the show. George Galway, a really outspoken populist from England, when he's being quizzed in a Senate hearing, I want you to be very clear on what you're hearing the charges leveled against him at the beginning by the head, the chair of the committee, and then his response. We'll cover about that much because it'll give you an idea. Then if you have a chance, go up on Gary Knoll YouTube and download the 22-minute segment of me in front of the New York State Health Committee under oath and how I go after them on their lack of science, medical ethics, unusual piece. I was there to defend parents whose children had been damaged by vaccines, doctors, nurses in New York State who didn't believe they should be forced to take the flu vaccines, which contained thimerosal, the mercury product at 24 micrograms. And I was the only one. I was the first one to sign up in the morning. 8 o'clock, I signed in. Now, they always take you based upon where you sign in, first, second, third. They took me dead last. At the end of the day, when the news media was not there, when the place was virtually empty, save for one doctor, this one doctor filmed this. Had this not been filmed, no one would ever know this blistering, in-your-face confrontation between myself and the ranking medical commission of New York State occurred. But it did occur. It's a matter of record. And this is how I believe all consumer activists should approach challenging authority figures. Watch this, because you will not go to sleep during this exchange. Anyhow, we're going to show you what happens when a guy goes to Congress and is put in the same situation. Now, normally our guest occurs at about 30 minutes in the program, but however, today we're going to have our guest at the beginning because he has to teach. He is Dr. Michael Hudson. He is one of our nation's most important progressive economists. He is a Wall Street financial analyst. He is currently the president of the Institute for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends and was the chief economic policy advisor for Representative Dennis Kucinich. Also, he's a professor of economics, University of Missouri, and he has served as an advisor to the White House, the State Department, Defense Department, at the Hudson Institute, and also at the UN. And he's written the book, The Bubble and Beyond. And we're going to start the program because he's on a tight schedule, so we'll go to him first, because I want to know about our nations moving around the world towards dumping the dollar. I'm asked about this all the time, because I keep saying, what do you think that is going to happen when the dollar is no longer the primary reserve currency, but mixed currencies become that in many parts of the world? People say, well, that'll never happen. All right, let's talk with Dr. Hudson to get his perspective. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you very much, Gary.
Okay. It's a relatively straightforward issue, and I'm going to ask the question and let you take it from there and run with it. Here it is. There is virtually no discussion that I'm aware of in the mainstream media and shared by the American public as to the current value of the dollar, the quantitative easing, which was not what we were told when you took all of that which was hidden, including bonds being and our debt being purchased through other countries, including Belgium. And according to the audit from Ron Paul and Bernie Sanders, total money printed and given to banks, principally, was $21 trillion. At 0.25 interest, and the collateral was nothing more than the worst assets a company had made. And at every level, this I thought was a scandal, but no one seemed to pay attention that this was serious. In fact, we were told not to worry, the United States never defaults on its debt. Fine. Okay, I accept that. But then along comes this. We never anticipated China becoming the world's leading economy. Some said it's not possible until they passed Japan 2.5 years ago. Now they're number two. Some say, well, it won't be possible because China's got a lot of its own economic problems, including a hidden financial disaster waiting to happen with its shadow banking system. After all, that shadow banking system built 63 major cities, some larger than any city or most of the cities in the United States, that are virtually empty, and a lot of corruption and graft. And again, people say it won't happen. But what if it does happen that China, over the next year or two or three, works with other nations in Central and South America, including Argentina, that's already volunteered to be on board, plus the BRIC nations, to have an exchange in their own currency, much of it backed by gold, and then the dollar no longer is the dominant currency of reserve? What will that mean? Do you see that as a possibility? Share your insights, please.
Well, you've combined a lot of different questions all in one. Let's begin with the quantitative easing. A lot of people say the government is printing money, and that's going to be inflationary. And most people think of inflationary as rising prices for consumer goods and commodities. The intention of quantitative easing and all these trillions of dollars that have been created is to inflate real estate prices and asset prices, not consumer prices or goods and services. The quantitative easing was entirely lent to the banks to spend, and banks don't spend money on food or cars or raw materials. They spend money on lending out and speculating and buying stocks and bonds and packaged mortgages. So the whole quantitative easing was simply a bank bailout. The intention was to make housing more expensive once again for Americans, to inflate housing prices and to raise stock market prices so that banks could earn their way out of debt, essentially by gambling on a stock market rise. And the whole increase in the stock market in the last 4 years has largely been on credit. One-third of the stock of all trade in stocks is companies buying back their own shares to push up the value so that the people, the managers who run the companies, can exercise their stock options and get more money, and to create money for shareholders and for speculators and for corporate raiders. So the quantitative easing is one part of the question you asked. The more interesting question that you asked is about China and other countries moving out of the dollar. They're not dumping the dollar. In fact, the last week has seen the dollar go up against the euro, which is sort of a Europe is a dead zone now, and against other currencies. The reason that other countries hold dollars is simply to hold down the value of their own currency. China's not doing that. The balance of what they are doing is saying, look, in the past, China has traded with Russia or other countries or Brazil, we've had to borrow from American banks. And just like the Federal Reserve has created all of these trillions of dollars simply by electronically creating them, banks create the money to lend to China, Russia, and other countries. Why on earth can't they create the money on their own computers? Fortunately, President Obama has decided to impose sanctions on these countries that has the good effect of forcing these countries to say, okay, you have sanctions, we will rely on our own computers. We're not going to use the dollar. We're going to, China's going to trade in renminbi, Russia's going to trade in rubles, and other countries are trading in electronic money created by their own central banks and by their own commercial banks. That's not really dumping the dollar. That's just becoming independent of the dollar zone. And by being independent, that means that the United States can't threaten them to say, you have to support the wars that we're in, or you have to let us buy part of your raw materials and your industry. And you in Ukraine, the kleptocrats have to sell us half of their business so that we can share in their what they're able to steal from the population. That's a completely a different thing. So I don't see necessarily that countries are dumping the dollar. They're just avoiding using it so that the world can develop into different currency areas independent of American foreign policy.
What will that do in time to the value of the dollar? Do you see it any time in the near future the dollar no longer being the universal reserve currency.
That's the intention of almost all the other countries. They say that the dollar has been pumped into the global economy mainly by U.S. Military spending abroad. That's the key balance of payments deficit that has occurred. And other countries say, wait a minute, we don't want to base our central bank reserves on America's military spending surrounding us now with NATO and with nuclear weapons and threatening us. This is crazy to have the international reserve currency military in character. So, of course, they're going to have an alternative to the dollar and not use it. That means that the value of the dollar will really concern itself, what is happening in the domestic economy here and Europe and America's allies.
Three interconnected short answers, if you would, please. One, do you see that after the scandals of banks being caught and fined for manipulating the price of the LIBOR interest rate and then the silver rate and gold, do you see any outcome of where gold or silver could go in the future, or will they continue to be repressed? Two, since we're told that we have a flourishing economy and that it's grown by 4.3% thus far this quarter, and I'm looking at figures that show we've actually increased unemployment, we've increased the amount number of people to 13 million who have simply stopped looking for work altogether and hence are excluded. And I cannot believe that the economists in America are not outraged by being lied to in this obvious gaming of the system. Why can't the government tell us the honest actual unemployment rate and then break it by unemployment rate among groups, African-American youth, Latino group, Caucasian group, and senior citizens who are still capable of working but because of age discrimination are being removed from the workplace. So the entire figures on employment and jobs are manipulated and gained. And lastly, what do you see as the likely outcome to our economic system in the next couple of years only?
Yeah, these are a lot of questions all tied together. Well, first of all, many economists are part of the deception, and many economists don't even realize they're part of the deception because in order to get a PhD in economics, you have to be pretty much brainwashed by the free market Taliban, the Chicago School. That's why at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, we modern monetary theorists, or post-Keynesians, have our own economics that emphasize exactly the points that you're making. Of course, the overall unemployment figures have to be broken down. And the fact is that long-term unemployment is increasing, and the economy is polarizing between creditors and debtors. This should be the center of what economics and newspapers are reporting. So the problem's not only economists. The question is what the media want to report. And the media basically give handouts from the government where everything is good news and everything is working out and nobody's suffering. But the reality is that people are still suffering and real wages are going down. So, I mean, it's almost easier to answer your last question, where is the economy going? The economy's not really going up at all. When people say the average income is going up, what they mean is very, very rich people, the top 1% of the pyramid, is really getting rich so much faster that it brings up the average. But if you look at the median, that is, if you line up all of the people in America and you take the one that's just in the middle, the median is going down. 90% of the population is finding itself more and more squeezed by debt, and nothing has been done to write down the debts to the ability to pay. So people are paying more and more money. Their credit cards are going up. Student debt is going up. How are how are people going to be able to buy more goods and services? How are they going to be able to keep industry going if they have to spend more and more money paying the financial sector, interest to the banks, higher housing costs? The housing costs are so high for the United States that that's really the reason that we can't compete. And people talk about, look, your house value is going up, you're getting richer. But what that means is that your house value is going up by borrowing money and going into debt and having to pay a larger and larger mortgage every month. And rents are going up. Housing prices are going up. So there's no way that America can really reindustrialize at all. The only way that it can survive is to continue to make other countries give it a free ride. And this is why other countries, to get back to your earlier question, other countries just say, look, we're not going to exist just to make America richer so that it can, because it's abused its wealth. If America used its wealth to help develop the world's industry and to make the world richer and more prosperous, they'd be all for it. But America's using its wealth increasingly for military purposes, essentially to surround Europe, to surround Asia, and to surround Latin America, and try to buy it out and move its industry abroad and become more and more reliant on foreign countries. And they're saying, look, we feel that there's a giant sucking sound and it's all into the United States. We're not going to do this anymore. We're going to be independent.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you very much for sharing that with us. By the way, one real quick answer. Do you feel that the price of gold and silver will remain about the same, or do you feel that at some point they'll go to their actual and realistic value?
Well, the question is, what is the realistic value? I would think that gold price would have to go up because the use of gold is basically to settle deficits among different countries. It's a peaceful metal. If you had a gold standard in the world, countries couldn't afford to go to war because any country that went to war would have to pay so much money that it would find all of its gold drained, which is what happened to America in the Vietnam War. Now, what's happened with the gold price is that artificially, the central banks and Wall Street have been selling it for basically selling it short, using financial manipulation to keep down the gold price. The question is, what happens if interest rates go up here and they can't borrow to keep pushing down the gold price? At that point, probably gold prices will rise. Certainly, China is increasing its gold, mainly by buying its domestic gold. It's not buying gold on foreign markets. It's buying it domestically. There's so much financial manipulation that it's almost impossible to say what's the real price of gold or silver when the real price is whatever people will pay, meaning whatever you can borrow from a bank. And so as long as the banks say, we're going to create an infinite amount of credit just to get to fix the game and betting against gold, it's very hard to say, how long this can stop until the point at which it actually does stop, in which case you'll have a very sharp run-up as you did in 1971 when the U.S. demonetized gold.
Well, I can't believe that we're going to continue with this Ponzi scheme in our American economy indefinitely.
We can't. Of course we can't. You're right. But we don't know exactly when it'll break. There'll be a break in the chain of payment somewhere, probably by some large fraud or large company gambling or somebody making a large bet and losing. So of course it cannot continue, but it's very hard to say in advance exactly when it will break down.
I agree. Thank you very much, Dr. Michael Hudson.
Thank you, Gary. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Michael Hudson. Now, from Health and Nutrition, from King's College London, the omega-3 fatty acids may prevent some forms of depression. That's good news. Also, it's been shown to help with hepatitis C. That's good news as well. And this was known, and by the way, this is not just the fish oil. It's found that the plant-based omega-3 fatty acids are actually more beneficial and more therapeutic for the body. So that's good news. It's shown that it can reduce triglycerides. Those are fats in the blood that can lead to heart attacks. Excellent. And it's anti-inflammatory in the brain, and it can help with depression. So that's excellent information that we just got from this study, and this was published in Biological Psychiatry. So if you're depressed, the omega-3 fatty acids, I would suggest twice a day, and that could help you. A new article shows that the daily use of certain supplements can decrease all of your health care costs. This is from the Council of Responsible Nutrition, published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Dietary Supplements. And it shows that those individuals using the omega-3 fatty acids that I just mentioned, the B-complex, and vitamin C and vitamin E, overall are healthier, and therefore the other illnesses that a person may have are substantially reduced. And I just taught this on Tuesday evening this past week to our health support group. The individuals, by the way, at the beginning of each group, we just started week 4 out of a 12-week session. One woman had lost 20 pounds, another 18. Blood pressure coming into normal already in just 4 weeks. Persons with diabetes were finding their fasting blood sugar levels were in the 70s and 80s instead of the hundreds. So we're seeing remarkable improvement in just 4 weeks. But one of the messages they've finally been able to fully comprehend is that there's no such thing as just one primary illness. You don't just have diabetes or cancer or dementia or heart disease or arthritis. What you have is an overall systemic challenge to the body, mainly because of what is inflammatory. And anything that is high-cooked, baked, like where you're crusting something, such as French fries or pizza crust or colas, caffeine, sugars, artificial sweeteners, alcohol, all of these create inflammation. So the inflammation may end up manifesting a noticeable symptom in one area of the body, but it's hitting every single cell of the body. So you can't just say, oh, I just have high blood pressure. No, you're going to have a lot of other problems beyond that, even if they're not yet at a clinically definable, measurable stage. Remember, before you get cancer, you might be cancering for 30 to 40 years. Then, at the end of that, when the body collapses, when you no longer can kill the cancer cells, repair the DNA, then and only then do you manifest your tumor. So when a doctor says, oh, thank goodness we got your tumor early, no, you got it late. You got it at the end stage of disease. Remember, by the time you manifest any symptom, migraine, headaches, fungus under your nails, you're at the end stage of tipping, not the beginning. Please understand that. So that study I just cited, what they're saying is by taking your supplements, you're helping all the other conditions in the body from tipping into full-blown disease, or helping those that are in disease by correcting the biochemistry. So that's good news. Take your supplements, drink your juices. Also, this is from the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, published in the peer-reviewed journal Neurology, which is the medical journal of the American Academy of Neurology. Quote, worry, jealousy, moodiness linked to higher risks of Alzheimer's in women. Quote, most Alzheimer's research has been devoted to factors such as education, heart and blood risk factors, head trauma, family history, and genetics. Personalities may influence the individual's risk for dementia through its effects on behavior, lifestyle, and reactions to stress. So what they did in this study, they found out that the more stress someone is under, the more they are likely to suffer from Alzheimer's. And here's how it works. This is relatively simple. Every time you get distressed, you create stress hormones. They're elevated, mainly cortisol, epinephrine. Those are very inflammatory. I mean, those play havoc in your body. But people never measure these. I mean, it's just never measured. As a result, we only measure the damage that they do as a symptom. So then you measure the amyloid beta plaque in the brain and say, ah, dementia, Alzheimer's. But they won't tell you what caused it. They're still looking at what this article said. They're still looking at head trauma, didn't have any. Genes, it's not there. It's distress. So this is showing that when you get in moods and you're angry and you can't resolve conflicts, then you're creating the biochemistry that leads to brain inflammation and the plaques that lead to Alzheimer's. Hence, the need for stress management and understanding how to deal more appropriately with stressful events. And finally, why should you eat avocado seeds? Well, from Plant Foods and Human Nutrition, the journal, it says this from Natural Blaze, quote, "Avocado seeds have more antioxidants than most fruits and vegetables and contain polyphenols similar to those found in green tea. They are full of more soluble fiber than most foods, which aid in digestion and circulation and helping treat dysentery and other GI tract problems. The seeds contain lots of phenolic compounds that can prevent bacteria and viral diseases as well as gastric ulcers. Eating the seeds may also aid in the prevention of cardiovascular disease and strokes. It helps lower cholesterol and protects against arterial plaque formation. And it also is good at cholesterol binding and removing that cholesterol out of the intestine. It also can help keep the arterial plaque formation from occurring. So, that's just the latest on something that most people threw away, never knew had any value. It does. From our environmental segment today, from the staff writers of Terra Daily, the article is entitled, "Changing Antarctic Waters Could Trigger Steep Rise in Sea Levels." It was 7 years ago that I said that we must prepare for an accelerated rising in the sea beyond what they've been telling us, meaning they were telling us, oh, it's 100 years from now, 200 years from now. No, it's happening right now. The Marshall Islands in the Pacific are being inundated right now. There won't even be anyone living on those islands another 5 years. But it's also with every single surge of a storm, it's flooding out systems in Miami, for example. Miami as a city is simply history. You won't notice it today. Probably not. If there's not a hurricane, you won't notice it. But it depends upon when you look. But if you were to look at let's say someone did an artist rendition, a three-dimensional rendition, and you saw it from the front, you would see how there's no bedrock there, and hence the sand, every time the water comes in, it brings the sand back out and dissipates it. And that means that it's at sea level and it is flooding. And the next time they get a Category 3 hurricane, which is inevitable, then you're going to see massive real estate sell-off. Massive. The real estate market will crash and burn in Miami after the next major storm. Because then all the people will be called on who are the experts. Well, what's the likelihood of this happening again? And can we build safe sea walls? No. Will this get better? No. Will it get worse? Yes. Are we living in a non-sustainable environment? Yes. Why didn't you tell us this before? Well, we didn't want to crash the real estate market, the bubble. That's that simple. Here's what it says. Quote, "Current changes in the ocean around Antarctica are disturbingly close to conditions 14,000 years ago. The research published in Nature Communications found that in the past, when ocean temperatures around Antarctica became more layered, with a warm layer of water below a cold surface layer, ice sheets and glaciers melted faster than when the cool and warm layers mixed more easily. This defined layering of temperatures is exactly what is happening now around Antarctica. Quote, the reason for the layering is that global warming in parts of Antarctica is causing land-based ice to melt, adding massive amounts of fresh water to the ocean surface. And that's from Professor Matthews, England, and author of the paper. At the same time, on the surface is cooling, the deeper ocean is warming, which has already accelerated the decline of glaciers on Pine Island and Totten. It appears global warming is replicating conditions that in the past triggered significant shifts in the stability of the Antarctic ice sheet. And they're saying that Antarctica alone contributed 4 meters to global sea levels. So there you have it. So we have 700 million people living less than 10 meters above present sea level. So those people are going to be affected in the upcoming future. I'm Gary Knoll. We're going to take a break and come back. I'm going to play a piece where first listen very carefully to the charges against parliamentarian George Galloway, and then listen to his response and ask yourself, have you ever heard of anyone testifying before the United States Congress to the head of a committee in the way that this man did? This is a lesson in how to stand up for yourself after you've been accused and degraded in the media and by the government agencies and agents of the government. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. We're going to go to George Galloway testifying before U.S. Congress in just a moment. I won't play the whole thing, but I have the whole thing on our website. I want to mention that we're well up over 100 postings per day. I want to thank the nearly, we're just about at 3 million impressions per 24 hours. 3 million every 24 hours. Wow. All over the world, people are coming, reading the articles, watching the documentaries, listening to the programs. We thank you for that. And it's growing exponentially. And next week, wow, do I have a bunch of hard-hitting shows coming. I've already written the commentaries. We've got some guests lined up you've never heard before talking on topics that you didn't know about. So I'm very excited about what's coming at us. Let me mention also, for those who may be looking for work or want a better job, I'm going to be making some time to interview over the weekend. I'm going to be hiring a store manager who must have experience managing a store, being good with people. I'm hiring a personal assistant, either part-time, 3 days a week, or full-time. Must be bright, detail-oriented, be able to do research on a computer, work with people, because I haven't had a personal assistant now in 4 years. And with all that I'm doing now, I'm here at 5 in the morning and I'm here until 1 in the morning. So I've got to get more balance in my own life, but I just have too many things I'm having to do and I got to delegate. If I had a good personal assistant, I could do that. These are all good paying jobs. And also hiring editors, people who have a good, strong background in editing and research. So if you have any of those qualifications, for any of those jobs, call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. Now let's hear the testimony before Congress.
Mr. Galloway, I'm pleased to have you before the committee today. What I'm going to do is briefly summarize the evidence before I give you a chance to give your sworn testimony. The Oil for Food program was used to support those who were favorable to Iraq, former Iraqi Deputy Prime Minister Tariq Aziz and Iraqi Vice President Taha Yassin Ramadan confirmed this. I would think that you would admit that your efforts to oppose the sanction were well received by the regime. I know it's been quoted to you many, many times, but your, I would say, infamous statement to Saddam Hussein on January 21st, 1994, where you said to Saddam, Your Excellency, Mr. President, I greet you in the name of many thousands of people in Britain who stood against the tide and opposed the war and aggression against Iraq, continue to oppose the war by economic means, which is aimed to strangle the light out of the great people, life out of the great people of Iraq. You then went on to say he greets you in the name of the Palestinian people. You went on to note that I thought the President would appreciate knowing that even today, 3 years after the war, I still meet with families who are calling their newborn son Saddam. You went on, ultimately, at the very end, to say, "Sir, I salute your courage, your strength, your indefatigability, and I want you to know that we are with you." And I believe it was in Arabic, "Hatta al-Nasr, hatta al-Nasr, hatta al-Quds," which means until victory in Jerusalem. And I also would note that you have stated that you deeply regret those comments, and that the comments were not aimed directly at Saddam, but they were aimed at the Iraqi people. In the fall of 1999, you headed a two-month London to Baghdad bus trip to gain support for lifting the sanctions on Iraq. We have your name in Iraqi documents, some prepared before the fall of Saddam, some after, that identify you as one of the allocation holders, that your allocations were then used by Fawaz Zarqat operations operating under the name of Iridium Petroleum and the Middle East Advanced Semiconductor to actually lift the oil. We know, too, based on the statements of former Iraqi officials as well as some documents, and in the cases of Vladimir Zhirinovsky and Alexander Volshin, correspondence and documents, that allocation holders knew that surcharges or oil allocations were paid to Saddam Hussein, and that allocation holders were aware of this and responsible for the payments. We have also heard testimony regarding several documents retrieved from the Iraqi Ministry of Oil, that demonstrate how Iraq allocated oil to its friends and allies. Exhibit 13, which you've seen, displayed a SOMO chart that demonstrated Vladimir Zhirinovsky's dealing with Machino Import in Phase 11. That chart also lists contract M1104 with Middle East Advanced Semiconductor. Footnote 93, her testimony regarding a SOMO commercial invoice dated June 27, 2002, that shows Middle East Semiconductor loaded 2,360,860 barrels of Iraqi crude oil pursuant to SOMO crude oil sales contract M1104. Exhibit 12, we heard testimony regarding correspondence from the executive director of SOMO to the Iraqi oil minister, providing details of contract M1104 and listing your name in parentheses next to Middle East Advanced Semiconductor and Fawaz Zarqat, who we know lifted the oil. Again, statements of detainees, including former Vice President Ramadan, confirm that the name in parentheses, your name, is the allocation holder. We heard testimony regarding contract M1104, which was signed on December 12, 2001, between SOMO and Fawaz Zarqat, president of Middle East Advanced Semiconductor. We heard testimony regarding SOMO commercial invoice B13201 that shows Iridium Petroleum lifted 1,014,403 barrels of Iraqi oil pursuant to SOMO crude oil sales contract M923. Exhibit 45, her testimony regarding a SOMO chart entitled Crude Oil Allocations during Phase 9 of the Memorandum of Understanding that indicates contract M923 was executed between SOMO and Mr. Fawaz Zarqat / George Galloway / Iridium Petroleum. Exhibit 9, we also heard testimony regarding a memo from the executive director of SOMO to the oil minister requesting approval of contract M923. The document includes an official Ministry of Oil stamp dated 1-15-2001. And provides details of the contract M923 signed with the Iridium Petroleum Company Perens Fawaz Zarqat - Miriam's appeal, indicating that the allocation recipient for contract M923 was Fawaz Zarqat, Miriam's appeal. Mr. Galloway, as I indicated in my opening statement, this is not a court of law. This committee has simply made available information obtained during the investigation from interviews of former Iraqi officials, as well as Iraqi documents that lay out how the oil for food program worked, how allocations were given to favored friends, how allocation holders made substantial commissions selling those allocations to oil companies, what Ramadan called compensation for support, what another official, when talking about another allocation holder, said, of course they made a profit, that's the whole point, how surcharges on oil contracts were given back to the Saddam regime and were the responsibility of the allocation holder. The evidence clearly identifies you as an allocation beneficiary who transferred the allocations to Fawaz Zarqat, who became chairman of your organization, Miriam's Appeal. Senior Iraqi officials have confirmed that you, in fact, received oil allocations and that the documents that identify you as an allocation recipient are valid. If you can help provide any evidence that challenges the veracity of these documents or the statements of former Iraqi officials, we'd welcome that input. Mr. Galloway, you're appearing before the subcommittee without asserting any privilege or immunity. Indeed, your appearance before the subcommittee is entirely voluntary and on your own accord. No subpoena was issued to secure your appearance. You're appearing before the subcommittee concerning matters that do not arise out of the performance of any of your official duties as a member of the British Parliament, but instead concern actions taken by you in your capacity as a private citizen. Before we begin, pursuant to Rule 6, all witnesses who testify before the subcommittee are required to be sworn. This time I would ask you to rise and please raise your right hand.
You swear the testimony you're about to give before the subcommittee is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
We will be using a timing system today, Mr. Galloway. We could have 10 minutes for opening statement. If you need more time, we'll certainly accommodate that, and you may proceed.
Senator, I am not now, nor have I ever been, an oil trader, and neither has anyone on my behalf. I have never seen a barrel of oil, owned one, bought one, sold one, and neither has anybody on my behalf. Now, I know that standards have slipped over the last few years in Washington, but for a lawyer, you're remarkably cavalier with any idea of justice. I'm here today, but last week, you already found me guilty. You traduced my name around the world without ever having asked me a single question, without ever having contacted me, without ever having written to me or telephoned me, without any contact with me whatsoever. And you call that justice. Now, I want to deal with the pages that relate to me in this dossier, and I want to point out areas where there are, let's be charitable and say, errors. And then I want to put this in the context that I believe it ought to be. On the very first page of your document about me, you assert that I have had many meetings with Saddam Hussein. This is false. I have had two meetings with Saddam Hussein, once in 1994 and once in August of 2002. By no stretch of the English language can that be described as many meetings with Saddam Hussein. As a matter of fact, I've met Saddam Hussein exactly the same number of times as Donald Rumsfeld met him. The difference is, Donald Rumsfeld met him to sell him guns and to give him maps the better to target those guns. I met him to try and bring about an end to sanctions, suffering, and war, and on the second of the two occasions, I met him to try and persuade him to allow Dr. Hans Blix and the United Nations weapons inspectors back into the country. A rather better use of two meetings with Saddam Hussein than your own Secretary of State for Defense made of his. In the same opening paragraph, you assert that I was an outspoken supporter of the Hussein regime. This is false. I have brought along here a dossier for all the members of your committee, of statements by me as early as the 15th of March 1990, in which I condemn the Saddam Hussein dictatorship, in the most withering terms, a stance I have taken since around about the time you were an anti-Vietnam War demonstrator. I was an opponent of Saddam Hussein when British and American governments and businessmen were selling him guns and gas. I used to demonstrate outside the Iraqi embassy when British and American officials were going in and out doing commerce. You will see from the official parliamentary record, Hansard, from the 15th of March 1990 onwards, voluminous evidence that I have a rather better record of opposition to Saddam Hussein than you do and than any member of the British or American governments do. Now, you say in this document, you quote a source, you have the gall to quote a source without ever having asked me if the allegation from the source was true, that I am, quote, the owner of a company which has made substantial profits from trading in Iraqi oil. Senator, I do not own any companies beyond a small company whose entire purpose, whose sole purpose, is to receive the income from my journalistic earnings from my employer, Associated Newspapers, in London. I do not own a company that's been trading in Iraqi oil. And you had no business to carry a quotation, utterly unsubstantiated and false, implying otherwise. Now, you have nothing on me, Senator, except my name on lists of names from Iraq, many of which have been drawn up after the installation of your puppet government in Baghdad. If you had any of the letters against me that you had against Zhirinovsky and even Pasqua, they would have been up there in your slideshow for the members of your committee today. You have my name on lists provided to you by the Dofer inquiry, provided to him by the convicted bank robber and fraudster and con man Ahmed Chalabi, who many people, to their credit in your country, now realize played a decisive role in leading your country into the disaster in Iraq. There were 270 names on that list originally. That's somehow been filleted down to the names you chose to deal with in this committee. Some of the names on that committee included the former secretary to His Holiness Pope John Paul II, the former head of the African National Congress presidential office, and many others who had one defining characteristic in common. They all stood against the policy of sanctions and war, which you vociferously prosecuted and which has led us to this disaster. You quote Mr. Taha Yassin Ramadan. Well, you have something on me. I've never met Mr. Taha Yassin Ramadan. Your subcommittee apparently has. But I do know that he's your prisoner. I believe he's in Abu Ghraib prison. I believe he's facing war crimes charges, punishable by death. In these circumstances, knowing what the world knows about how you treat prisoners in Abu Ghraib prison, in Bagram Air Base, in Guantanamo Bay, including, I may say, British citizens being held in those places, I'm not sure how much credibility anyone would put on anything you managed to get from a prisoner in those circumstances. But you quote 13 words from Taha Yassin Ramadan, whom I have never met. If he said what he said, then he is wrong. And if you had any evidence that I had ever engaged in any actual oil transaction, if you had any evidence that anybody ever gave me any money, it would be before the public and before this commitment today. Because I agreed with your Mr. Greenblatt. Your Mr. Greenblatt was absolutely correct. What counts is not the names on the paper. What counts is where's the money, Senator? Who paid me hundreds of thousands of dollars of money? The answer to that is nobody. And if you had anybody who ever paid me a penny, you would have produced them here today. Now, you refer at length to a company named in these documents as Eredio Petroleum. I say to you under oath here today, I have never heard of this company. I have never met anyone from this company. This company has never paid a penny to me. And I'll tell you something else. I can assure you that Eredio Petroleum has never paid a single penny to the Mariam Appeal campaign. Not a thin dime. I don't know who Eredio Petroleum are, but I dare say if you were to ask them, they would confirm that they have never met me or ever paid me a penny. Whilst I'm on that subject, who is this senior former regime official that you spoke to yesterday? Don't you think I have a right to know? Don't you think the committee and the public have a right to know who this senior former regime official you were quoting against me interviewed yesterday actually is? No. One of the most serious of the mistakes that you have made in this set of documents is, to be frank, such a schoolboy howler as to make a fool of the efforts that you have made. You assert on page 19, not once, but twice, that the documents that you're referring to cover a different period in time from the documents covered by the Daily Telegraph, which were the subject of a libel action won by me in the High Court in England late last year. You state that the Daily Telegraph...
There's 30 more minutes to this discussion and then a blistering exchange between the legislators and George Galloway. On every single point, he completely shreds the attack against him. What's important when you hear the entire thing is how the government will set someone up who has been against this war and is against its policies, and how we've approached our efforts in the Middle East, and how they'll try to destroy the person's reputation. But you don't destroy George Galloway's reputation, and he proved it in this. Just wanted to share that with you. We're out of time. I thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more in our next program. Have a nice day. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have one quick email here, which I think will be, you'll have an interesting answer for. We may not have time today, but a listener asked and they wanted to see what your perspective is on the current scare over the Ebola virus and all the cases that have come out.
You have to keep it in perspective. First off, always look at what is the advantage in scaring the public? There's an advantage always. You just have to figure out where it's at. Is it because they're trying to promote a massive new vaccination program or some form of medication program or to create an advantage for some governmental agency? Or in the likelihood that they're none of the above, it's just simply overwhelming, vigilant hysteria. In the average day, every day, an entire jumbo jet of people die at the hands of medicine, just taking medications that were properly prescribed but were bad medicines. Why isn't that being dealt with as an epidemic? But it is. When you kill 700,000 Americans each year or thereabout, that it gets no attention. But if one American gets infected, then suddenly it's every bit of news is about that. And so what they should be doing is they should be taking all the different nations in the world who have expertise in handling emergencies such as the Ebola virus and bringing their medical teams and health support teams to those countries and setting up labs so that they can test the people and help the people there. But where are the people getting sick? These are people principally who are poor, who don't have good water, who are malnourished. And instead of ever looking at the underlying cause of most illnesses, poverty, they look at what to do once a person is sick: quarantine, medication, death, burial. They're just looking at the wrong approach. If we approached all major diseases in Africa, especially infectious diseases, of how to help the people, prevent the conditions, then we wouldn't have this in the beginning. We wouldn't have it. People with strong immune systems, people who are not exposed to bad water and poor nutrition, overcrowding, these are not the people coming down with the major infectious diseases. So the entire approach is wrong, in my opinion. And scaring the public to the degree that we have is counterproductive. So that's my answer.
Okay, thank you.
All right. And now let's say hello to Yatrice Lead. Hi, Yatrice.
Hello, Gary. Today, we're talking about First Nations and the nation, Native American sovereignty, and U.S. land and treaty law.
Good. I'm going to be having a whole program on that next week also, with the woman who is one of the leading professor emerituses on Native American culture and true history. So I look forward to hearing yours today. Also, one other thing, Luann, we know that intravenous ozone kills virtually all viruses. We all know so colloidal silver kills over 500 bacteria and viruses. Why aren't we giving the people in every one of those infected areas ozone and then giving them colloidal silver? Just those two things alone could stop it from manifesting in people who are infected and infecting other people and help save lives. Now to you, Therese Lead.